So, Joe, I don't know if you have anything else to add on that. I know you were working with Barbara.
Yeah, no, I think your answer was spot on, Ann. You know, the big thing is, you know, we deal with communicable disease outbreaks in school settings all the time, and we work very closely with the principals of the schools, the school districts, to make sure that the outbreaks are handled appropriately, that everybody who has been in contact with cases have been notified and quarantined appropriately, depending on the situation. It may prompt a school closure, depending on how broad the level of exposure might have been. And we work very closely with, you know, the school leadership to do that. You know, the part of the question was, should parents notify schools if their child has been diagnosed with COVID? And generally, that is what that would be very helpful, because then that way the parent is actually giving the child's name to the school leadership. And if they do that, they're doing that consensually. They're basically consenting to, you know, disclose their child's name. And so that's how we, you know, that can be very, very helpful in these types of situations.
Thank you. I'm going to change directions here a little bit. A very important question, actually. Do you still, or should you still get, do you have to, or should you still get the flu shot? And if so, do you know how that will interact with COVID-19?
Sure. This is Joe McLaughlin. I can start with that. So the flu shot is highly, highly recommended, and it's recommended for everybody 6 months of age and older. And we know that influenza causes hundreds of thousands of illnesses, up to millions of illnesses every year. I should say definitely millions in the United States, and then hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations and tens of thousands of deaths. So it depends on the severity of the flu strain or flu strains that are circulating. Some years fatality rates counts are in on the order of about, you know, 10 to 12,000 fatalities in the United States. In some years, they're upwards of 80,000 fatalities or higher in the United States every year from flu. So flu is definitely something we do a lot of messaging around to try and promote flu vaccine and respiratory hygiene, ways to prevent transmission of influenza. It is not required, but it is highly encouraged. And so we will be mounting a big influenza vaccination campaign this fall, trying to get as many Alaskans immunized as possible. And that's because influenza symptoms are very similar to COVID symptoms, with the fever, cough, shortness of breath, chills, sometimes abdominal cramping and diarrhea can go along with flu, which you also see with COVID. So they can be very, very similar to each other. And so we really want to minimize the cases of influenza this year so that we can have a better chance of really detecting COVID cases early. So those are, I guess, the big things I want to say about flu. Anne, anything else you would add?
The only other thing I would add is I think that all of Alaska has learned about hospital capacity in a way that they may not have known beforehand. But our hospitals do become overwhelmed just with flu or with RSV on a fairly regular basis. And so particularly in November, December, when there is elective surgeries going on in combination with flu, and then in the spring, late winter, early spring, we start to see RSV cases. We can get very close on vents. We can be needing to ship people to Washington. And we can be having people board in the emergency department for days on end. And so you get a little bit more disease, even just a little bit of COVID on top of that. And we could really overwhelm the healthcare system quite quickly. So we're trying to build those things up. Building up healthcare capacity is a challenge in all sorts of ways. And having a bed doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be well. The best way to be well is to prevent the disease overall. So in general, continuing all of these measures to minimize the risk of viral transmission of respiratory illnesses will be important through the fall and winter, as well as getting your flu vaccine.
All right. Thank you. I do have a bit of a, it's a longer question based on something that's going on in Ketchikan right now. This is a question from a community member, so I'm going to set the stage as they have. A traveler took a COVID-19 test Saturday at Ketchikan's airport. Then officials say he or she ignored quarantine orders and attended social gatherings over the weekend. Today, we learned that traveler has COVID-19, and now Ketchikan is dealing with the domino effects of a person who chose to ignore state mandates. First, how do we deal with folks who are challenged with understanding the science behind the warnings of this pandemic and think they know better than the experts? And second, would the state support a borough or municipality if they came up with mandates more restrictive than the state?
So yeah, I appreciate that question. And I think that's been a tough series of days in Ketchikan here recently associated with that case. Again, we really want to try to not stigmatize individual people. People do make mistakes, or people don't always make the choices we would want them to make. We have speed limits. I have sped. I have gotten a ticket. We are not perfect in 100% of what we do. And how we get people to follow those things, I think, is by a community, by all of us working together to just really model that as well. So again, having a big group gathering is hard to stay away from. My kids don't get to go to play dates because then it's really easy to give each other hugs. And they, I don't see that as really great right now. They can go for walks with their friends distance apart on the street to keep that 6 feet apart. So I think that we all owe a responsibility to our communities to model good behavior. I think it's really important we don't stigmatize individuals. I think that we do our best to be able to understand a complex disease and complex changing science. I think it's important to remember this disease didn't exist 6 months ago. And I think that we find ways to be kind to each other. This is hard on everyone. This is hard on businesses. This is hard on, you know, our kids who haven't had school. This is hard on healthcare providers who, you know, normally if you take care of a car accident, you're not worried about getting run over by a car. And now they're being asked to take care of a disease. If they don't have PPE, they could get it themselves. This is hard on policymakers. This is hard on city leaders. This is hard on everyone. And I think we just need to be kind to each other and realize that there's going to be breaks in the system, and we just find ways to fix it. Regarding local mandates, the governor has been very clear that he is willing to support local, more restrictive measures. Again, the state mandates are kind of the basic, and then many communities do layer on top of that. The one caveat is if you have a mandate that would restrict access to a necessity or like a critical service. So say you have a critical access hospital, you couldn't make a mandate that said only the people in this town could access that hospital if that critical access hospital serves a larger community. And so that is the one area that the governor has been pretty clear about. We do have numerous communities that have a lot of other different restrictions and mandates that can be applied. And so communities are welcome to that, and he has been quite supportive of that.
Thank you, Dr. Zink. Another question from Caleb Veerkamp, the Wrangell Sentinel news editor. Is there an estimate on when the pandemic will finally pass, a vaccine will be rolled out, or anything similar to that?
It's a great question. Yeah, go for it, Joe.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I can start on that one if you want.
Go for it.
In terms of the vaccine, there are a number of different vaccines that are currently in various levels of clinical trials. And there's one vaccine produced by Moderna that's an mRNA vaccine that I'm sure many of you have heard and read about. The earliest we would see that vaccine come out, I think it just starts to enter phase 3 clinical trial very soon in the next couple of weeks. And what we're being told is the earliest we're going to see that come out for a very small subset of the population, we don't even know who it would be available for, would be sort of, you know, at some point later this fall. Probably it would be prioritized for people who are, first responders would be my guess. But we'll have to see what CDC says on that. In terms of how long will the pandemic last? Well, you know, it really depends on how long it takes for us collectively, globally, to develop herd immunity to the actual virus. And you can develop herd immunity through prior infection as well as through vaccination. So our hope is that we will have a vaccine that becomes available more widely so that we can vaccinate a sufficient proportion of the population to really decrease transmission and see the end of this pandemic. I suspect this strain of coronavirus will continue to circulate in human populations for years to come. Right now, as I mentioned, there are four human coronavirus strains that they're the so-called minor human coronaviruses that cause upwards of anywhere from 10 to 30% of upper respiratory tract infections in adults every year, common cold. And so this particular virus will probably continue to circulate in human populations for years to come. And hopefully over time, it will become more attenuated and result in less severe illness.
The other thing that I'll just add to that is we get a lot of questions about herd immunity. I think it's important to also realize there are many diseases. Smallpox is the first one that comes to mind that circulated around the world for a long time. And we never, quote, got herd immunity until we got a vaccine. And so I think that that's just an important context, particularly with the introduction of a new or novel virus, because there has been, this talk of, well, why don't we just let it go as quickly as possible and have people be exposed to it and get to that point of herd immunity as quickly as possible. And so I want to put that in that historical context. We don't know if we would ever get to that point with just causing mass death. And we see young people being affected by it. We see, about 50% of people who are hospitalized are under the age of 65. And so just because you're hospitalized from this disease does not mean it's not very severe. We're seeing strokes associated with it. We're seeing young kids having it. And so the main way to get to herd immunity is with vaccines. And we are hoping this fall we'll see something along those lines. We are also seeing promising work both on more rapid testing as well as other treatment options. To see the scientific community come together in the past 6 months and come up with just tremendous science and treatment options has been, I get goosebumps talking about it, but it's just phenomenal to see the amount of literature and research and community going together. And so while it feels hopeless hearing about smallpox and mass death and circulating for years, I think it's also important to remember the tremendous science that's happening and the options that I think will be coming online. We already have treatment options that we didn't have 3 or 4 months ago. Even our state is in a totally different place than it was when this pandemic first started, with testing options, with knowing how to care for people with COVID, with treatment options. And every day we learn something new. Every day, I'm grateful it's one more day we had a chance to learn to be able to be better prepared for this disease.
Thank you very much. We are running down toward the close of our hour here, and I want to respect the time of our guests. I think a number of us would be willing to go a little bit longer, but Dr. Zink, I understand you are doing this with numerous communities around the state every day. So if you need to close out at 6:30, we perfectly understand. I do want to let the listening public know there are a handful of questions that are city and borough of Wrangell specific. I've held off on those just to make sure I could get the questions, as many questions asked of Dr. Zink that pertain to her while she's, and Dr. McLaughlin while they are on the phone. So I'll continue with a couple more questions, and then if you guys need to leave the meeting, wonderful. So the next one, I'd like to get back to contact tracing from a community member. Can you describe the concept of contact tracing and its limitations? And then in parentheses, it says some people are assuming the responsibility of tracking down close contacts falls completely on the state. Can you speak to that a little bit, please?
Sure. This is Joe McLaughlin. I can start with that, and maybe Ann can continue on and add to what I have to say. Basically, with contact tracing, what happens is when there's a new case of COVID-19 that's identified, a laboratory-confirmed case, then we have contact tracers, which include public health nurses and epidemiologists and other folks who will contact that person. And they'll do an interview. They'll find out when their symptoms started. Now, some people, they don't have any symptoms, and that's a little different. But let's just take the people who have symptoms. So let's say I'm calling Ann Zink, and I say, Ann, when did your symptoms start? And I go through all the symptoms that that we know about for COVID-19, and just to help jog her memory. And then she might go back, let's say, 3 days from prior to today and say, you know what, actually, I did have a little bit of a runny nose 3 days ago. So what that means then is that her infectious period starts 2 days prior to her symptom onset. So if her symptom onset was 3 days ago, then we go 48 hours prior to that and we say, Anne, tell me every single thing that you did starting 5 days ago. Let's start from when you got up in the morning. Who were you in close contact with? And then did you have breakfast with anybody? Did you go to work? And we go through that hour by hour every day during her infectious period. And we identify who are the people that she came in close contact with. And we define that as being within 6 feet of a person for at least 15 minutes. And then we get their names and we find their phone numbers. If she doesn't have them, then we figure out ways to find their phone numbers and contact these people. And we let them know, each one of them, that they have been in contact, in close contact with somebody who has been diagnosed with COVID-19. And we don't tell them that it's Dr. Anne Zink. We just say, we can't tell you who it was that you were in close contact with. And then we do that for every single person that Anne has been in contact with during that time period. So that's how contact tracing works. And what we tell those people is that starting from that day that they were exposed, they need to be in quarantine. Usually we say if they're a resident of Alaska, it's home quarantine for 14 days. That's because the incubation period for this virus is anywhere from 2 to 14 days. So people who develop symptoms, it can take as long as 14 days, but typically it's more on the average of about 4 or 5 days. Now, for people who don't have any symptoms at all, then we start on the day that they were diagnosed with they actually got the clinical specimen taken, the swab, and we say 48 hours prior to that day is when your infectious period began. And then we go forward from there and do the same thing for asymptomatic people.
I was just gonna say the things that you can do versus the state. So we do like contact people, but two, if you get a phone call from someone from the state, please answer it. Two, we're just here to help. If you get that call, we're not here to, there's no law enforcement coming after you, but we have been having some challenges in some of those calls, so be kind. Three, if you can keep track of who your close contacts are, that's really helpful. So if you've seen 100 people last week, that's a lot of phone calls for us to make, and that's a lot of potential disease spread. And so if you can keep your circle small, one thing I oftentimes say is if you can't name everyone that you've been in contact with the last week, it's probably too many. So think about spreading out who you're seeing or how you're seeing them to keep those circles really small. Keeping track of it, there's apps that can keep track of it. You can keep it on a calendar, other ways along those lines to be able to minimize it. And then if you are asked to be in quarantine, realize that that's for you and for your community. It's hard and it's frustrating and it's incredibly long, but it makes a big difference for your community to go ahead and follow through on that 14-day quarantine period if you're in close contact. So I think as this is wearing on, people are also getting tired and I get it. I'm over COVID too. But I think the disease sets the timetable, not us. And so appreciate the partnership.
Thank you for answering.
Go ahead, Dr. McLaughlin. This is Joe McLaughlin. I'm going to have to end the call from my side at this point.
Thank you so much, Dr. McLaughlin. We really appreciate you giving Wrangell your time this evening.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Zink, I think we will ask one more question of you and then be respectful of your time. And then we will, perhaps Erin, the public health nurse, can stay on if she's got a little bit more time. And then we, as city officials, can answer some questions. So the last question I'll ask Dr. Zink is, now that this is a question actually from the Emergency Operations Center, now that the state is in the latter stages of the Reopen Alaska plan, what is the strategy moving forward?
Yeah, so great question. I mean, I think we're trying to figure out how to move into a sustainable way of living life. So making sure that we are doing the things that are meaningful and important to us, but also mitigating the disease at the same time. We are continuing to stand up our emergency operations center. So some states aren't. So some states are kind of collapsing those down. Part of it is we really see summer in the next kind of month and a half is higher risk for us, partially because all the seafood workers who are coming in, firefighters who are coming in. This is when Alaskans move a lot, do a lot. This is when a lot of people make their income. And so trying to support businesses in as many ways as possible. So we got a lot going on right now, and we'll continue to need to see how we respond. That being said, we're continuing to try to move into more normal operations in as many ways as possible. So the first set of mandates were really to try to build up the healthcare infrastructure and slow things down while we got up testing, while we got up tools. The second set of mandates were essentially guidelines on how to start opening up before there were any national guidelines. Like there were no national guidelines on gyms and restaurants and things like that. So we wanted to kind of, our cases were low and we were like, let's get people moving back again so this is more sustainable. But now that there's like over 1,000 CDC guidelines and every industry is coming up with a set of guidelines on how to do their industry, you know, we pulled away the rest of those and we just have a few left specifically around travel and seafood and healthcare. And even the healthcare ones are all really kind of being made in combination with the board right now. So we're really kind of moving completely out of the mandate phase, moving into a more sustainable, but we'll likely be in the emergency operations center for a bit. And we're keeping all of our alternative care centers in a warm ready status through probably early fall to mid fall, at least, depending on what that looks like. And I had a pretty humbling set of conversations last night talking to my colleagues in Texas and Arizona, where the hospital systems are becoming very overwhelmed. And we're already starting to see significant delays in testing as that surge of patients in the lower 48 is starting to hit. And so we do worry about, you know, PPE again and testing. And while we're trying to kind of purchase as much as we can, make as much as we can, we've never got out of the first wave, but we may have a significant real ramp up in a second kind of bump of this first wave for a bit. And that may really limit supplies again. So I'm worried as a country that we are headed that direction. And I'm worried that our state has a lot of movement. And so we're trying to make sure that people can do as much as they possibly can. But it really takes every Alaskan wearing a face covering, staying 6 feet apart, washing their hands, keeping those circles small so that we can keep businesses open, that we can keep living and thriving in as many ways as possible.
Great. Dr. Zink, do you want to close there? Do you have time for a couple more questions?
I have about 7 more minutes. So if you want to throw me a couple more, I can do just a couple more questions. And
I will do that. One question is, have you seen good examples of how businesses can communicate which mitigation practices they are using to help prevent the spread? I want to support local businesses, but I get concerned when I go shopping and enter a business where their staff are not wearing masks. It makes me wonder if they are disinfecting the establishment properly. I would like to know what the business is doing before I enter so I can make informed decisions.
Yeah, I really appreciate that comment. I think that's great for business owners to hear as well. You know, we definitely kind of see a variety of different comfort levels in general. And if you can offer to your clients a variety of different options so that you can come inside and eat or you can take away, then it will help make people feel more comfortable. That being said, we have a business toolkit that should be coming out probably tomorrow. It's pretty much ready, including a website with a whole bunch of very Alaskan, everything from stickers that have like extra tufts that are like Alaskan stand together, 6 feet apart, stand here to kind of like help space out people, tools to be able to mitigate, these kind of like posters on being like kind of a COVID conscious business and other tools that business owners can put up and to use to really kind of show that they're helping to mitigate the disease itself. We've also seen communities, Fairbanks has really kind of taken the lead on this recently. They are really working very closely with their community business partners to be able to kind of mitigate the disease and keep businesses open. I think the other thing that's important to remember is that the virus is the enemy. It's not economy or health. Health always does better when economy does well, and your business does better if you have healthy workers who can work there and you have healthy patrons who can shop there or eat there or support there. And so I think if we can keep a lid on COVID, we can keep so much more open. So more business stuff coming out shortly.
That's great to know. Thank you very much. I think last question here. This is from June, our KSTK radio representative. We know wearing masks and washing hands prevent the spread of the virus, but as the state opens up businesses and gatherings, can we get some advice on the risks of certain kinds of activities and gatherings? Say, is an outdoor gathering of 100 people more or less dangerous than going to a restaurant with 10 patrons inside?
So it's a great question. We did do a blog about kind of what sort of activities to think about for risk and no risk. There was a great little diagram from another state where it kind of like gave a number, and we've been a little bit hesitant to do that. It always can be challenging when someone says a group of 100. If it's like a wrestling group of people of 100 outside, then that's probably still not low risk. But if it's 100 blueberry pickers, that's probably really low risk. So again, it depends on what sort of activity that you're doing. In general, the closer you are with the more people and the more indoors you are, the higher the risk. I would say that one thing that has been changing in the science and we've been learning more about, initially, we were thinking a lot about both coughs and sneezes and surfaces. I think that the surface aspect is looking to be, it's still there, but less of a risk for transmission. And these micro particles and kind of small aerosolized particles are becoming clearer as a bigger point of transmission. And that's why you heard kind of the importance of masks, but then that also really hits the importance of having windows open in a building, eating outside, doing your event outside. We've seen some really bad outbreaks associated with like shouting and with singing and when people are projecting their voice as well. And so other things to consider. So things you can do, like churches can do music that's with instruments instead of singing. You can do things outside, like trying to think about any sort of way that when you're projecting your voice, that is either protected by a plexiglass, by a mask, or it's in an outside event. I think that the data is really shifting that direction. And it wasn't that it was one way and it was the other. We just didn't know. And we were going based on what we did know about the disease and what we knew from influenza. But those micro droplets are clearly becoming a bigger part of transmission. So I hope that helps answer your question.
Yes, thank you so much. And thank you, Dr. Zink, for spending more than an hour with us tonight here in Wrangell and answering all these questions. We know how busy you must be with everything going on around the state. So our thanks to you.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you for the awesome questions. You guys are like the most organized. You had like all of them put out beforehand. It was fantastic to see. So thank you for all of your help. Always happy to come back or have other people. You've got Aaron, who's fantastic, or, you know, our testing guy or labs and supplies or other components. So we're all in this together, always happy to come back another time. So have a good rest of your night.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we will stay on the line, folks. And there are a handful of questions that were asked specific to the city and borough. And I'd like to try to run through those for folks here. So the first question is from Caleb at the Sentinel. Does the city intend to make any MOU agreements to help businesses pay for COVID-19 testing like they did for sea level seafoods? So I think the answer to that is yes, the EOC has been considering options for expanded testing for business cohorts. And we encourage anyone to reach out to the borough that might be interested in that. And we're having ongoing discussions. So my answer is, please get in touch with the borough if you are interested in testing your employees, and we will be happy to work with you. The second question is, how is the Harding Sourdough Lodge isolation site being used? Is it to quarantine anyone, travelers or who? Is it only for individuals who test positive? Or is it also for individuals waiting for a result? So I appreciate that question being asked. Sourdough Lodge is being used as an isolation site for people who have tested positive, who need to isolate away from other folks. And it can be used for travelers who have come to Wrangell, let's say flown into town and get a test result that's positive and need to isolate in a location. It could be, let's say, for a fisherman that's come in from another area and tests positive and doesn't have a place to go and needs to isolate. It could also be for a local member of our community that lives in a domicile with other folks where they cannot get appropriate isolation within their home. And so those are the ways that we're using it. But I want to be very clear that the isolation site is only for people that have tested positive. It is not for folks that are waiting to hear what their results are. And any other member of the EOC that's on the line, please chime in to assist in answering these questions if you have them, if you have additions to what I've said. Give me just a moment to turn the page here and I'll get to the next question. I believe the last question is from Caleb at the Sentinel, and it says, how much of Wrangell's CARES Act funding has been spent already, and what future expenses does the city plan to cover with that money? So a significant amount of the money has not yet been spent, but it is what I would call allocated. And so Wrangell received just over $3.851 million. And we are using a significant portion of that money to offset the cost of staff time that is being repurposed for COVID-related response. So for this year, we anticipate using approximately $592,000 to reimburse staff wages for time spent for COVID. That includes existing employees that we have repurposed our time for COVID-related activities, for employees that we have whose time has been bumped up, they've gone from part-time to full-time to assist with COVID activities, and employees that we have brought on fully. Almost just under $900,000 to reimburse staff wages. And part of the big chunk of those wages is that the CARES Act allows for 100% of your first responder wages to be taken care of by CARES money. So that's all of our police. We actually got confirmation today that also includes dispatch and all of our fire EMS staff as well. Then there are a number of ways that we are either spending money or are planning to spend money this fiscal year within the next few days and for next fiscal year. And we can break those out if anybody is interested. But the way that things are anticipated this year is the assembly has approved $400,000 currently for community programs, both for businesses and individuals. And we're working through rolling those out to the community. We have approved $60,000 right now for the lease of the Harding Sourdough Lodge. That's the alternate isolation site. We have purchased cleaning supplies and hand sanitizer. We have purchased some equipment. We purchased a refrigerated trailer to act as a morgue site next to the hospital. We are planning some improvements, not only for borough facilities, but also for the school facilities in terms of touchless door entries and fixtures like touchless or flushless toilets and touchless faucets and touchless paper towel holders, things like that. There's a number of things, and we're happy to provide a list to anybody so that I don't have to go down this. But right now, what we have anticipated spending totals of just over $2.5 million with everything that has been currently allocated. Again, that's not expended, that is estimated and anticipated. The other thing I forgot to mention is that the borough did purchase an ambulance, and that should be here, my understanding is, within about a week. I don't know if anybody from the EOC wants to add anything to that list.
Lisa, you're muted.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Captain Spray. We do have a handful of other questions here that we can try to go through and answer, I think. And some of these may be able to be answered. Some of them may not. Erin, are you still on the line? Erin from Public Health?
I am.
Great. Erin, you might be able to answer this question. This is from June at KSTK. What is the most current reproduction number for Alaska? Is there a Wrangell specific reproduction number?
Yeah, I probably would have to defer that to a section of epidemiology and Dr. McLaughlin. I don't have that information. I'm sorry.
Gotcha. I was not able to get to that question before they signed off. So we will pass. There's a question from one of our assembly members, Julie Decker, and that is, Wrangell residents were concerned to learn more about follow-up and contact tracing after we saw our first four confirmed cases in the past 2 weeks. However, the information provided by the state regarding follow-up on the confirmed cases, including follow-up testing, results of these tests, number of possible contacts to be tested, et cetera, was slower and sometimes incomplete, and that caused quite a bit of anxiety to the community. Is it possible for the state to provide more information to the public regarding follow-up with confirmed cases, yet maintain patient confidentiality? Erin, you might be able to help with that.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely something that can be improved upon each time we have a new positive case in the community. I think we're getting better and better communicating amongst the various different entities, the CERT communicating with public health and EOC and the state section of epidemiology. Each of those entities, you know, when you've got a lot of moving parts, it can be challenging to get it down to a smooth process. But I think each case has gotten a better as we've gone along.
Thank you very much. I am looking through the list of questions here, and I think we have asked almost every one of them, or they have been answered in a wrapped up in a group of questions that were asked previously. So with that, I think we may be done this evening. I'd just like to ask if any member of the EOC would like to follow up with any comments before we close for the evening. If not, I'm...
You have a question. It looks like you're ready to ask a question.
I'm sorry, Kim.
Representative Ortiz looks like he wants to ask a question.
Oh, certainly. Representative Ortiz, please go ahead.
Actually, thank you for that. And can you hear me?
Yes. Okay.
I don't necessarily have a question. I just have a little bit more information as a result of a meeting that took place yesterday for the House Finance Committee. At that meeting, DCCED talked about that they have made to the thing for small business relief more available. And the way that they're going to do that, it's my understanding that prior to this new ruling, if you will, people who have received any form of federal funding, let's say PPP funding, for example, they could not qualify to apply for any of this $290 million in small business relief. However, after yesterday's meeting, people who have received $5,000 or less can now apply for part of that $290 million. Also, there's the option if you have received PPP funds and greater than $5,000, but that you return those funds, you can also then apply for the $290 million. And the nice thing about the $290 million is it comes in the form of grants rather than loans. And so I just wanted to make that available. I think also, 301C or 501C, anyway, nonprofits, C6, they can now apply for those funds. And I think that's about it. I think that's the only change that that has been made. But I just wanted folks to be aware of that. If they felt frustrated by the fact that they might have applied for those funds early, like they were instructed to do, and now fall out of the category of receiving further funds in the form of grants, they now can receive those funds if they, in fact, have received less than $5,000 in federal aid. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you very much for that update. That's extremely helpful for the business community.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity for joining in tonight.
We appreciate you joining us, as always. All right, everyone. With that, I think we will call it a wrap for tonight's community meeting. We appreciate everybody taking time out of their busy schedule to sign on and learn more about COVID-19 and how we're moving through this.